The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 153, a paper entitled, What We Can Learn from the Handwriting of Joseph Smith and Other Church Leaders. What does your handwriting say about you? The presenter is Julie Lopper Cook.
Hi, welcome to session number 153, What We Can Learn from the Handwriting of Joseph Smith and Other Church Leaders. What does your handwriting say about you? Our speaker for this session is Julie Lopper Cook. She has experience teaching critical thinking, English as a second language, English composition, and Spanish at Savannah State University. I think it was last year you moved to Mount Zion in Illinois and taught high school Spanish, which she says she's hoping not to repeat this fall. Her expertise is in handwriting analysis, and she is also a substitute organist. With that, I'll turn the time over to her. Just a couple quick things. Please turn off any cell phones that you might have on, anything like that. Let's see. Admission to this session is by name tag or ticket only. If you haven't purchased a name tag or a ticket, please do so. Julie says that she needs as much time as possible, so I'll shut up and let her have the time. There will be time at the end for a few questions and answers.
I also want to let you know you can ask questions during the session. I'll have to repeat them in here, or you can come up to ask them. I also want to encourage you to come as close as you can. There's a lot of small writing on the overheads, and especially over here. You're not going to see that well in the back because I'm going to be standing right here. But let's go ahead and get started. Like I said on the board, I'm going to give a very brief outline of graphology, just to kind of get us started. But I want most of the time, of course, to be on Joseph Smith's handwriting and your own handwriting. Okay, what is graphology and how is it used? Does anyone already know a bit about graphology? Yes. What do you know about graphology?
I've studied it a little bit, and I know that you can tell a lot about people, a lot about yourself. And an interesting thing is I tried to camouflage when I sent it in for an analysis, and I wrote completely different from my regular handwriting it is, but it came out the same.
Yeah. It seemed to be different, but there's things you just can't mask. I was one of you maybe who went to the fair and put their signature in and got a little printout, and I thought, yeah, that's hokey, whatever. Or I thought it was done by psychics. So when I found out that there was a science to it, that there was a consistent pattern, that's when I became very interested and decided to become certified. Well, how is it used? So many ways. In just ways that we're currently using it, question documents, of course, working with the FBI to track down people, get relevant information about people, leave notes. A lot of people that I know get their jobs in helping in the hiring process. There are some employers who don't even disclose this to the potential employees. So be aware, they often use your writing as a way to screen the applicants. There's people who have very lucrative full-time jobs helping in that process. Also, entertainment. You know, we get hired for all-night graduation parties just to have fun with the teenagers or just whoever is interested. Of course, what I was interested in and what many of you might be interested in, just insight into your own self and to those people that you know well. One thing that has amazed me as I've practiced graphotherapy or graphology is the people that I thought I knew very well, every time I see their handwriting and study it, I find out something new and very interesting that helps me really understand the people that I care about more. And that was a surprise to me. And then the other term, graphotherapy, there is a field of therapy using graphology. Well, how does that work? The assumption is that your handwriting reflects your thoughts. Okay? Change a thought, your handwriting is going to reflect it. Change a pattern in your life, your handwriting is going to reflect it. Well, what they've done is done the reverse. Okay, I'm going to consciously change my handwriting to put a new thought into my mind and thereby change my life. And what do I know about this? Not a lot. Because I myself have changed my handwriting since I became certified, but I haven't been able to be, you know, totally unbiased and scientific on myself because lots of things have changed. But I've noticed a significant change enough to keep doing it. One thing that I've changed, and I would suggest to anyone, is your T-bars. I'll just throw this out here because it seems like a good time. Even your lowercase T's, it's recommended that you cross them at the top, which means you project your goals high into the future and you have the willpower to make it happen. George Bush crosses his T's at the top. Anyway. So it's something that I have started and I recommend. So that's the idea behind graphotherapy, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes, there was another trait. I'm known as being kind of inflexible at times, very decisive, you know, proactive. And I thought, well, you know, with my two girls, I could use a little flexibility in my life, a little more flexibility. So I sought to change that quality in my handwriting. Lo and behold, I ended up driving myself batty because what came along with that flexibility was indecision. And I just, oh, I can't decide. I'm so flexible. You know, these boys look good to me. I went back to being decisive and, you know. So, yeah, you change one thing, be careful because it will change another. But that's graphotherapy, and they say only change 3 letters at a time maximum because it will kind of shake you up a little bit. And the way that you go about changing your handwriting is you practice a 3-letter set like ITE, for example, 1 sheet of 1 paper each night for 21 days. So you're just trying to establish a new habit of thought and then let that activate in your life. So that's graphotherapy. Well, what are the origins of graphology? I'm just briefly going to buzz through this. Some original interest was by Chinese philosophers. They said, wow, you know, the calligraphy is different according to personality. That's interesting. It just started to generate some interest. In ancient Greece and Rome as well, just started to notice that the handwriting was changing according to the person writing. The first known systematic attempts to study and describe the relationship between handwriting traits and character traits was done in Italy in the 17th century. A couple studies were done, and then it just basically tapered off a little bit. Continuing interest in France in the 1830s. Abbé Flandrin and his disciple spent the rest of their life, over 30 years, doing systematic analysis, looking at different personality traits and how it's reflected in the writing. They basically did a trait analysis. Okay, this mark indicates this aspect of personality. Now, today we have the 2 types, the Gestalt and the trait analysis. Those who look at the whole picture and just look at the general trends in the handwriting, and those who want to look at every little trait. And there's some, you know, arguing in those fields today. One thing I think is interesting, not that impressive, but interesting, you have, you know, Italians who are right now studying the connection between neurology and handwriting. You have the French who are using handwriting analysis. I think it was 80% of top French companies consult handwriting analysis in hiring decisions. In Germany, handwriting analysis is regarded as a branch of applied psychology, and graphologists are frequently consulted in vocational medical diagnosis fields. The Swiss graphology was a required course for psychologists in most medical programs. You currently need a PhD to be a graphologist. So this is where the other countries are going. The United States, we just really haven't picked it up as quickly. The one most interesting aspect in the United States, I would say, is the IGAS. Back in 1910, Milton Bunker, he looked at what the French were doing, the Germans were doing, and he combined systems into a field called graph analysis. And he did lots of empirical studies to try to confirm which traits in handwriting reflect the traits in personality. And right now, that is the biggest organization of handwriting analysts, and they have the standardized tests that you need to pass in order to become certified, etc. Okay, any basic questions there? Just wanted to skim. Well, IGAS, it was originally, let's see what, American Institute of Graphical Analysis, AIGA, and then Bunker incorporated AIGA as the International Graphical Analysis Society, IGAS. Yeah. There's several ways you can do it. You can do inside or you can do correspondence. I did the correspondence where you will watch, you know, workshops by video, then you will have to submit 10 tests and then a final exam and a standardized exam, etc. So, or you can do it in-house if there's a location near you. Yes. Yeah. And I've just been doing it for 2 years. I'm just still very excited by every analysis I do and how the people say, wow, your method's working. I don't know how, but it's working. And that's, I basically got a vocational training. This is what you need to do. This is what works. And it seems to. But with that in mind, any other questions about the basic history before we move into the good stuff? No? Okay, with that in mind, a little apology to Joseph Smith, who's not here to defend himself. You know, the first time I've done analysis. Well, no, I can't say that. I've done analyses for my brother's girlfriends that they didn't know about, but besides that, this is the only one. So where I got the samples was from a book called The Personal Writings of Joseph Smith by Dean Jesse. And it's published by Deseret Book. And I have the ISBN if someone wants that after. And they had so many copies of different handwriting samples. And I just picked 6 to refer to during this presentation. Well, let's start into it, and I hope there's something that you can see in this handwriting. I know it's not easy. Okay, I'm going to tell you what I found, but also tell you how I found it, so hopefully educate you in graphology as we go along. Now, in a handwriting, there's... When you have, for example, the letter M or N, you have two trends. One is to make a rounded top, and you're not going to see that. A rounded, and then another would be a pointed. Who has rounded? Who has pointed, let me ask? Who has points in their N's and M's? That's it? Who has rounded? You're not sure. Well, okay, and then a lot of you aren't sure. Well, the rounded has to do with manual dexterity. The pointed, let's see if I can do it well, has to do with intellectual probing. So the intellectual dexterity. A combination, wow, great, you know. First one rounded, the second one pointed. You're a good mix there. Well, as you can probably see already from Joseph Smith's intellectually probing, lots of points. So you know all the stuff we talk about, poor ignorant Joe Smith? I don't think so. Very keen intellect. Very probing, quick mind. And that's what we can get from those valleys in his M's and N's and W's and U's. Can you see what I mean? I know it's not a piece of cake with this writing. Let me look, like for example, see the point on the N where others might round it? He's going to point it. He's going to point it. Point it. All these points, these have to do with intellectually probing. And that's Joseph Smith. Another aspect that really stood out to me with Joseph Smith's handwriting was his organization. He has a really neat S. He has lots of them, but here's one example. You see how the S is formed and balanced. Look for those in S's especially, and that's going to indicate a tendency towards being organized. Well, that's the most common way to see it. You can do it in other letters as well. The lowercase s means something else altogether. Okay. Well, the lowercase s, I'll just throw it out there, not tease you. It means simplicity. If you write your s, but the reason I almost started laughing a little bit, you know, if you write your s just simply kind of printed like that, it's a simplicity s, but that also might mean you like to go bare naked at home, you know, just kind of be down to earth, simple. So, anyway, what else do I notice about Joseph Smith? His eyes, they're dotted very carefully. That is definitely an attention to detail. They very rarely stray far from the eye. So he's got attention to detail, and some analysts have believed that that means loyalty. If you show sustained attention to detail, that you will also be likely to be loyal. Yes. In a minute, I'm going to kind of wrap those together with some other similar characteristics. So, and the eye also repeatedly, with attention to detail, is going to enhance memory. In fact, in graphotherapy, one practice that they have often kids do who are struggling in school to enhance memory is a page of perfectly dotted lowercase i's. So that's an attention to detail which can enhance memory. Well, let's look at Joseph Smith's baseline. The baseline is the line, of course, that you're writing on. How closely does he stay to the baseline? All you budding graphologists, what do you think? How closely does he stay to the baseline? Fairly close. And that would indicate kind of a conformity, dependability. I have a teenage brother who's all over the place, like often teenagers are, you know, really not settled in their direction, but he's more constant. There, he tends to have an upward baseline. Can anyone guess what that would mean? An upward slant to the baseline?
Optimism.
Optimism, exactly. Except for this poor letter to his brother Hiram. I don't know what was getting into him there, but you can see how downcast that letter is. But that's the only one. Especially when he would write to Emma, you'd have a you'd see a lift in his handwriting. And that's an optimism. We look at margins. Now, you can't tell all that you need to from these overheads, but a typical margin, you know, something like this. This is not indicating his true margin. It's just the way I copied it. But a regular margin would have, you know, an equal amount on each sides. Well, Joseph Smith, what he does is this is the beginning of the margin. That's the end. He leaves no margins, at least in those few samples that I was able to look at. So what does that mean? Filling up all kinds of space, trying to fit 48 hours, you know, into 24. It also shows kind of a fear of quiet, could even be a fear of death, but just really needing to fill up all that space. And for some people, that's a really attractive quality, very charismatic. For other people, it's very overwhelming. personality trait. And so that's one that he has. I've noticed, I looked at a lot of his lower loops. Let me just give you one basic principle. You have three zones in your writing. And I wish these pens showed up well. But the upper zone is, what can you guess what the upper zone represents? What's that? Yeah, abstract, intellect, exactly, or the mental. You can even think of it as the body, the head, the emotion, the physical. So here is his intellectual or abstract zone, then here's the emotional, then here's the physical or material zone. And you can look at your own handwriting. Well, when I look at Joseph Smith, what sticks out to me? Well, he has a very prominent upper zone and a very prominent lower zone. His middle zone is less prominent. The middle zone is the emotional zone. So why is his emotional zone kind of restricted? Well, there's a couple things. He's got some repression there, and I don't blame him, because when you have this slant that he has, that's a very impulsive personality, that is a very emotional personality, that is a very reactive personality. He needs to have approval, contact, you know, this is heart over head. So I would say that, do you see how this, what I'm talking about by the angle? Who writes up straight up and down? Anyone in this room, their letters go, okay, Alan. Now that is a reserved personality. You are, that's head over heart. Okay, that's analytical. And you're not? And you're not head over heart? So am I. I'm actually, that's one of the things I'm trying to change. I'm actually trying to loosen up a little bit and try to be a little more heart over head, kind of slanting it a little bit more to the right. So if you're straight up and down, you're very reserved. You're very analytical. Well, look at Joseph Smith, poor guy. Very slanted to the right. That's a very emotional. So I can see why he might want to restrain those emotions, because that's a lot to deal with. So that kind of works as the brake and the gas there. What else are we looking at? Let's see. Lower loops, they do generally come around, which would indicate follow-through. But there's something else indicated in the lower loops, and he generally crosses back over the lower loop before getting to the baseline. And let me see if this is the best. I don't know if you can follow that because of this copy. But let's say he goes down and then crosses over before he would come up to the baseline. That indicates an emotional trauma at an early age, like the first third of the life. So if your loop crosses back over the line before getting to the baseline, that's an emotional trauma. One thing that I noticed were some efficiency strokes, and I can't blame him with all that he was involved with. But one way to look for it in your own writing or in others, just taking shortcuts in writing, obviously, is going to be efficient. F, just going up and down. When he starts letters, just starting in on them and not doing lead-ins to letters. That's the simplicity. Who just goes right into their letters? For example, T. Who makes their T simple like that? You do both? Okay. So that's a simplicity stroke. Sometimes the L's, well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Because that would quicken your handwriting just like you would take shortcuts in your life. Yeah.
I'm thinking that, you know, in the 19th century, people learned Spencerian math. They were sort of grown into that education. Do
Yeah, his question is excellent. Does the way they were taught back in the day affect are there significant differences from today? I'm sorry, I didn't get that right. Anyway, there's a couple things to keep in mind. There's a copybook at this time period. It's different from our copybook. In other words, they were taught differently. And, in fact, a lot of emphasis was put on handwriting back in the day. And that's one reason why I have a selection of Joseph Smith's contemporaries, just to throw out there as a comparison every once in a while. Yes, they were taught copybook, different from today. But no, they don't always stick to it, and that's significant. Also, here's some of his friends, and I know it's minuscule, but let's just look, for example, what are some obvious examples in the differences between Joseph Smith and his friends? What's that? The angle, yep. You know, a lot more angled. What else? These guys? Yeah, I was very surprised at how controlled and perfectionistic that handwriting is. Yep. And they're dealing with the same books. You know, when Joseph Smith does his history. I'm also very interested in how much globs he has all the time, and we'll notice that throughout. And that is significant. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But so it's interesting what was taught at the time, but also the departures, and I'll point those out as we go along. Now, what I believe, and there are probably some other graphologists who believe differently, but it would appear that these traits are standard through the time. So therefore, if a copybook teaches, for example, T's with high crossings, well, then that's going to put out kids who set high goals. Do you see what I mean? Just like today with the middle zone writing that we have, I didn't see a single sample from that time period that has the middle zone writing that the teenagers have today. And that middle zone writing is all about the emotion, about the now, about the instant gratification. And that wasn't in that time period. So, yeah, there are definite trends, but it still holds the same significance. Does that answer that question?
A lot of kids these days don't even use long hair.
Yeah.
They print. And they never get to practice long hair. And they print rather fast.
Yeah. And
can you analyze that?
Yeah, we do analyze print. Can you tell some... What would print mean compared to cursive? If a generation starts printing, okay, simplicity. What else?
We have 6 missionaries out right now, and they all write, and they all print. And I just think it's because they learned everything on the computer.
Exactly.
They did not learn cursive.
It's exactly right. They are starting to think like the computer. But one obvious difference, it's disconnected. Where are the connections between the letters? And that's exactly the emotional trends of the time, disconnected. Think about the computer mentality and how it is affecting our lives. Communicating through email rather than person to person, where is the connection? You're right, it is starting to reflect the computer. And what's that saying about the trends in our society? Yeah. Right.
So I learned about cursing.
Yep.
I don't
know what that has to do with computers. I know some people that print before that, and they couldn't write anything, but they didn't learn it on computers. I mean, the computers weren't even in operation. Yeah. And generally, I was working with a group, Japanese. Well, guess what? The Japanese engineers all printed. It's also a trend for engineers. That type of thinking in mind and detail-oriented. But you'll notice for yourself. You'll take a look at your friends, and you'll start to see the trends for yourself. Getting back to Joseph Smith, one thing I thought was interesting, there's the characteristic in writing that is coined a desire for responsibility. You're willing to, you know, bear one another's burdens, whatnot, take on some responsibility. Well, Joseph Smith seems to put that in his signature, this is a responsibility loop. And he does it maybe two other times in all his pages, which... So, yes, he has that desire for responsibility. You can see it in Father. Responsibility, desire for... See this added loop at the beginning of Father? Or Joseph, how he puts the extra loop in his handwriting? If I was going to do, for example, instead of writing, let me think, a D, try to do it like that. This is a responsibility loop added on to a D that would otherwise look like that. Or B. So you take that off, you take off that, you know, desire to, women often get it, holding on to their responsibility to their kids. What I thought was interesting when I did Joseph Smith's, I had recently been asked by a relief study to do an analysis of all those relief study presidents through time, and they had this quality in such a large degree. And then I look at Joseph Smith and I think, look at all that he was responsible for, but yet he still wasn't, he really didn't manifest that quality as... That's great. I thought that was interesting. Alan?
I'm really interested in learning more about, I mean, some of the symbols, your interpretation of the symbols of handwriting, I think, might be kind of obvious. For example, the baseline going up might be obvious.
Yeah.
And so forth. What about some of these things like the loop being about responsibility? I missed the introduction here, but how does that translate into responsibility?
Like, how did somebody come up with that as the trait?
Right. Maybe like, and, you know, I can understand the emotion and some of the symbols seem quite obvious.
Yeah. You know, I think that could also be considered obvious if you think about you have this burden on your back. You know, if you consider this is the middle zone and in your body that's your back, you're kind of weighing yourself down with an extra loop. Loosely, just for the reason that this is the intellect, this is the emotion, this is the physical. So it can almost kind of correspond to our idea of where the mind is, where the heart is. But that's just kind of help people get it in their minds. But where did that come from? Really, it just came from looking at how is all handwriting analysis developed only by looking at different samples. One way that they would test it is you have your psychological test, you compare it, thousands and thousands, and start looking at which handwriting qualities correspond to those psychological tests from those psychological results. A lot of the studies in America have been done by kind of those people at a mental hospital, see what is striking about their handwriting, what's missing, those who are physically ill or mentally ill, how does that impair, change their handwriting. So some of it, like you say, is obvious and apparent. And every once in a while, some of the things are just what's come down through observation, through years of looking at it. And then but really, it's a science, I guess, if you could put it that way, but especially in art. You know, what I really need to do, yes, you can look at individual traits, and you can look at general trends, but the art really comes in when you can start putting A plus B. And really getting a handle on human nature. Let me give you an example. You have one quality of Joseph Smith that is so striking is his desire for debate and argument. This P, and I'd be curious if any, oh, here's a responsibility B, by the way. But see how the P goes all the way up? The stem goes all the way up. Does anyone else have that? Okay, you like to debate or argue. Now, while that could be an endearing quality, that could be a really offensive quality. It depends on some other qualities. Well, in Joseph Smith, he also has this tremendous stubbornness, tremendous. This is one of his very significant qualities. Look at this T. That's called a tent. That is a very stubborn quality. And this is an argumentative quality. Put those together. Okay, he's going to be a strong debater. You also put that together with a quality that he has, which is fluidity of thought. And if some of you have this, I think it's a great quality, myself. Really fluid mind that also translates into fluid speech. can really speak easily. And he must have really had a way with words. So put that together with this ability to debate and argue, you can see why so many people were influenced. Did you have any questions up front? No? Okay, let me see where I'm going to find for you the fluidity of thought. Well, I'll come to it in a minute, I think, because I'm getting myself ahead of myself. All right, some other qualities are, well, like I said, in the emotional zone, he is repressed or suppressed, which, depending who you speak to, you know, if you're speaking to Emma, maybe she wouldn't have liked it as much. But one thing that's great about that kind of repression is he's not going to be sensitive to criticism. When you have a handwriting that is not going to loop on your T's, and let me give you a sign of kind of depression. If you know somebody who's making this tremendous loop on their D, they're very sensitive to criticism. Somebody who's sensitive to criticism also is going to be very empathetic. You know, they have that ability to feel, but this is really going overboard, so they're likely to be depressed. Joseph Smith, on the other hand, represses the sensitivity to criticism, goes straight up and down. So you can see how it can work for the benefit or the detriment, depending what quality you're looking for. Number two. Here. In your handwriting, the word Lord, any letter that's going to form a figure eight is going to be fluidity of thought. A lot of people form it in their G's. People who are going to form it, see if I can make one. They kind of go like that. Does anyone make make figure eights in their writing? So that's a sign of fluidity of thought and speech. One thing that I thought was interesting about the handwriting in general, well, okay, you've got the stubborn, you've got the argumentative, but you don't have a lot of irritation strokes. So at least it's tempered by that. Irritation strokes are lots of jabs and ticks. What would that look like if I have a T and I kind of tick it down, an I, just different jabs and ticks in your writing. Ease generally correspond to open mind, broad-mindedness. If you open your E's, you're broad-minded. If you close them, you're really going to need the proof to believe. You're not going to be real open to the ideas of others. Who closes their E's and who closes their E's most of the time? And who leaves their E's open? And then maybe some of you aren't sure what. Okay, there's some interesting qualities. Look at the T-bars. There's a lot that can be said for the T-bars. Do you notice in the T-crossings of Joseph Smith how they go far over? Can anyone guess what that might represent? Very long T-bars. It's basically a caution or self-protection. It's a covering. And then if you look at a T-bar and it goes down, you can just kind of imagine how that's like a dominating stroke, going down on something. And if it ends in a point, that adds sarcasm to the mix. Dominating with sarcasm. Can you tell me my time? Somebody?
Yeah, you've got about 20 minutes.
Okay, I want to give you all, who wants a chance to analyze their own writing? Because I want to leave some time for that. Let me jam through a couple more things with Joseph Smith. Your S's. Well, Joseph Smith's S's show that he's not someone that's going to be stepped on, you could say, not a yielding personality. This would be a yielding S, kind of a marshmallow, soft personality. And if you add your points to it, you're not going to You know, you're not going to be stepped on like that. That goes hand in hand with his stubbornness. Okay, talking letters. Does anybody know what those are by chance? Already studied it? Your talking letters. Yeah. A, O. What can we find out from your talking letters? Well, this person here would be frank, honest, and could keep a secret. Well, how do we know that? Somebody who, and this, again, can be obvious, someone who leaves their A's open, they're going to be open to talking a lot. And it's going to be hard for them to keep a secret even though they want to. Somebody who loops their O's, that means they're able to tie up information, hold secrets, but it could also, it's hard to do with this pen, it could also be a form of deceit. Someone who ties up both sides, wow, you know, that's some deceit, that can be a spy, you know, you've got the qualities to be able to tie up a lot of information. What we commonly call a lie stroke is just when there's a jab inside the talking letter. And that is keeping some information. Now, you could have the very nicest handwriting and then all these lie strokes, and you think, well, how does that fit? Well, it obviously fits. That person's so nice they don't want to tell the truth about people. You know, so you have to take it in context. Again, and if someone doesn't have a lie stroke, does that mean that they never lie or that they're always in the truth? Not necessarily, but it means that they believe themselves to be in the right, to be sincere. Yeah. Yeah, same premise. Yeah, that's the next step here. I was just going to point to a couple A's, for example. You can tell me right there, what's his A say? Yeah, it's open, frank, straightforward. You have, what I found going through, is that is the most prominent talking letters, are just the clear letters, and then he often had them open as well. So that would be likes to talk, and a frank personality. So whatever Joseph Smith did, according to his writing, it would indicate that he did not feel like he was tying up secrets and intentionally deceiving. That's what the writing says.
Now, your mood affects your handwriting.
Sure it does, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And here's other examples of O's. You can see that the trend in Joseph Smith certainly is to just to keep it simple. Oh, that's kind of interesting. It's just a little curiosity. Yeah.
How about you mentioned his watches, like I guess they call it
Pasiosity. Yeah. Yes. Does anybody mind if we, I don't know, can I spend a lot of time on this? Okay, this, for example, this is the physical zone. So you're really seeking some change of job, just constantly needing something new, stimulation in that zone. But all the way, this hugging to the left, this is the past. Look at how on this margin, he's all in the future, but really avoiding the past zone. This is the past, the self. I saw a lot of qualities that would indicate some emotional trauma. I told you about the crossing of the wise. This is also saying, you know, not wanting to let go of the protection of the early family, the mother, really not emotionally ready to move on. There's several other qualities. Let me go ahead and throw those out if I can quickly find them. His eye, whoa, it's called the capital I is very significant for your self-image. You really want to look at how you make eyes. That's one of your most important letters. I just had a friend that she had her eye like this. She uses cursive, But then when she refers to herself and her self-image, this is her I. Well, what does that mean? Very independent, strong, but feels like you're standing alone. You're not. It's not a connected I. So what is Joseph Smith's I? It's one that I don't usually see these days. It is an I of real emotional insecurity. Look at this I. We call it an embryo I, kind of still wishing for the womb. I hope so. That would be good, wouldn't it? And if I can't get one to show up really well for you, I can also draw it to my best. Oh, goodness gracious, that's another one of his little eyes. Another one of his little eyes.
What does it mean again?
It's a real emotional insecurity. Well, it's not the tiny, it's not just the tiny. I mean, the tiny is a start, isn't it? Because if you're going to feel real prominent, you're going to use a big eye. But it's also the way he loops around, like this. Ugh. My black's not working. This is his eye. It's this little embryo eye. Can you even get the feel from that eye, just the difference between a little embryo eye and a prominent, you know, self-contained eye? Well, what I think is really interesting, you look at that eye and you say, oh my gosh, it's not a very strong self-image. It's both small, lightly drawn, and with those immature loops. Well, then also add to that his signatures. We studied his signatures through time. What would it tell you with this? what does that signature tell you? Especially coupled with that eye. You know, I feel for him. This is somebody who is really trying to draw attention to himself. Look at how the Joseph Smith, look how prominent the Joseph is, even more so than the Smith. Really trying to highlight and that stand out. Really try to emphasize. But then you compare it with his writing and you see that really insecure eye. And you think about how that must feel. And then through time, look at this split. I thought this was so interesting. He wrote to Emma and he literally put a split between Emma's name and Joseph. Maybe historians know maybe what was going on in 38. Then he goes from, you know, this really highlighting of self to then not even writing out his full name. There's a real shift. Something my husband pointed out, and I don't even know. You know, we don't know if these isolated examples, how significant they are. To be significant, it really needs to be 50% of the time. But what does this look like? What does that name look like? Looks like Christ. I think that's so interesting. You know, towards the end of the name, not only Christ, and then he starts to lose the first name and lose the responsibility loop. This was from jail, wasn't it? And we'll look at, I have some from the different jails he were in and how that changed. So you have that really insecure self-image.
That bottom one's a forgery.
Which one?
The Jonathan Dunham.
Let's take a look at it and see if we think it's well done.
The bottom of the last hour. That's a Mark Hoffman.
Oh. Boy, it's in that book. Okay, let's see. Yes. Oh, goodness gracious. Another interesting thing about Joseph Smith's handwriting, and this could apply to your own, if you have a long upper zone, a long lower zone, a small middle zone, that's somebody who really, their mind is in the abstract and not so much in the daily, bored by the daily. And that's further emphasized by the R's that he uses, which we call flyaway R's. Which means bored with routine. So he does a little flyaway lowercase r. And then his pastiosity. I don't know what you all are going to think about this, but pastiosity, we briefly compared how he had a lot more. I mean, you have to keep in mind they're using ink wells at this time, so you want to give him a break to have all this ink around. But then again, his friends don't have it, so I didn't know how significant to make of it. But pastiosity is an indication of sensuality. You know, a lot of physical, sexual energy. Physically oriented, attracted to pleasurable activities, and intensely absorbed in their experiences. So a lot of sensual pleasure. One thing I thought was really interesting were his D's. Let's see, who can spot? Hopefully I can quickly spot a lowercase d. He takes his lowercase d's up to the abstract zone, loops them. Anytime you see a loop, you're looking at, you're giving imagination to something. If you have lots of loops where they don't need to be in the emotional zone, for example, that means you'd bring a lot of imagination to the emotion. So you might make up hurts where there's not. Let's say I'm making a U and I put some extra loops. That's imagination, the emotional zone. Well, let's look at Joseph Smith's D up here. This is in the abstract. Look at all that that imagination he's bringing into the abstract. And what's interesting is that it never comes back down to the baseline. So it never quite comes back to grounded reality. It stays in that abstract. It's very filled with imagination. One, two, three. You see them all through. Now, yes. It does look praying, calling upon God. Yeah,
so
God.
He
doesn't always with. Yeah. So his most prominent D's are these really stuck in the abstract, and the D also has to do with literary. Is a literary symbol, so a lot of imagination. Sorry. Imagination in a literary way. Let's see. Also, that quality by some is thought to be kind of a childlike, naive, or even poetic nature if you get drawn into the abstract D and don't come back to the baseline. I'll just flash you some of my other. This is from Liberty Jail. What's your impressions? Yeah, you still have the pastiosity. What's that?
Blotches.
My impression was that it was also much more careful. More restricted, and the slant wasn't as extreme, like he was really pushing himself to like keep it together. Yeah, that all could definitely play in. You look at it here, wow. We have never seen him write so straight. And again, that's in jail. I wonder what he was going through. And then, but this is one before the other two. Oh my gosh. You know, that's in Liberty Jail. That was written before the other two I just showed you. That one just seems like he's kind of losing it. More, you know, more messy than we've ever seen. His name, you didn't even sign his full name. So there seems to be, okay, here I'm losing it, and then here I'm really trying to hold it together. You just gotta really, I mean, what I experience is just really feeling for him. That has got to be amazingly difficult. Pretty good, actually. Every once in a while, he's spelled Mormon, M-O-R-M-A-N. I don't know, odd, but when he was referring to the Book of Mormon at least once, but his spelling was actually quite good, which again leads me to think he's very careful and conforming in that sense. You know, that really surprises me too. I don't want to make it that. Did he want to name it something different, or was it kind of like an everyman, Mormon? I don't know, but here it is, Mormon. Well, look, what do you think? Do you think that's an O? I mean, that's an O and that's an A. Yeah. But his spelling was quite good in general. What other questions? I didn't get that one. I didn't get any in that book. That would be so interesting to see.
Yeah, and also I'm curious about, you know, as he writes about different topics or different circumstances, different indicators that he made, but across that may have the interpretive of how he was handling those particular situations.
In the letters to Emma, they were more emotionally open than others, and that's kind of obvious. In some of the documents, and I don't know if it could also be the way they copied the documents, but the more straightforward documents were much more emotionally open as well, like that Nauvoo charter. When it didn't have to do with his personal, you can see it's a lot more loose. When it had to do with his history, it was much more perfected. Here, this is a history. Look at that. Compared to some of the others we've seen. So those are some trends. And I don't know if he's just thinking, wow, I only have this much paper, I have to be really careful. We don't know what was going through his head, but his history is much more perfected and careful than... those D's. Oh, they're going down more than before? Is that what you're saying? More grounded? Well, some of the copies, you can see the lines in it. They didn't always come out on these overheads, but yeah, I think a lot of them were written with lines. Yeah. Sensuality. You know, it doesn't always go hand in hand with having sex. It's just a sensual nature, you know, and I can't imagine, I don't know what he was experiencing there. Can't even. Yeah, enhanced need or interest. Oh, we do.
Is there anything about handedness?
It's hard to believe, but they say we should analyze them equally. I have a hard time believing that, but I have, you know, I haven't done any of my own studies to disprove that. I think it's, I mean, if you're interested in graphology, wow, this field is so open in the U.S., like I pointed out. There are so many ways to study, and... You would think, but my husband's slant is to the right. He's left-handed. You would think. To me, it's logical that there would be significant differences. I had hoped to get to the point where you could do your own handwriting, so I'm going to have to let you do that at home. I'll go ahead and pass it out. And I'm sorry that It was already small when I did it, and then when I made the copies, it's even less clear, and I apologize for that. But I have a handout that has some general guidelines if you want to go home and look at your own writing.
The way you have put the paper on the table determines a great deal about your slant.
Mm-hmm.
If you put the paper this way, you slant backwards. If you put it that way, you slant forward.
Yeah, everything that we do with the writing tells something about ourselves. None whatsoever. I'm not aware of any whatsoever. Wide open field, guys. So there's just a little jumping off point for you.
For the sake of the recording, we've got to call it quits on the session now. Thanks for coming, and a recording of this session will be available shortly out at the table there. So if you're interested, pick it up.